So, my name is Reka Albert, and I'm in the Department of Physics and also in the Department of Biology at Penn State. The starting point of my talk will be a slightly different, and it's also the point where I got into this field, and that is from all these high-throughput experiments, which give us large-scale interaction information about different components of a cell. So to represent all this high-throughput information, high-throughput interaction information, we need to represent them as networks. And it turns out that these networks are very large, surprisingly connected, and have a lot of non-trivial properties. So that's where I will be starting from. But then you will see that I will introduce the fact and the necessity of dynamic modeling of the processes that involve these interactions among these components. And then the models that I will be actually showing you will be similar and also complementary to the models you've seen so far. They will be dynamic models of networks about 50-ish components. And they will involve a lot of known interactions and a simplified way of modeling the dynamics. So ultimately, my plan is to show three examples from my own work, my own collaborative work, modeling a gene regulatory network, a signal transduction network, and the immune system and its interaction with pathogens. I may not get to present all three models, though. So I don't really need to tell you this, but there is a huge variety of different components, different elements, interacting elements of a cell. Just when thinking about proteins, they can have so many different functions and so many different interactions, and they can participate. Also, all the elements of a cell are in a constant flux of synthesis and decay. And cells themselves are continuously renewed. So I didn't know this until I was very surprised that every cell of a living organism or of us is renewed, and so in about a year's time, we will have almost no cell that's exactly the same cell that we had a year ago. So what I would argue, and what this argues for, is that it's the interactions among these components that are constants, and not the components, the identity or the abundances of the components themselves. So it's the network. And then what kind of network? Well, there are a lot of possible networks that one can construct because there is a diversity of interactions. So everything starts from gene transcription. So this is kind of a representation of the genome, and these are the genes. Genes are transcribed and translated into proteins. So these arrows would represent transcription and translation. And then a subset of proteins are transcription factors. What that means is they regulate the transcription of their own gene or of other genes, so you have these kind of transcription factor gene interactions. The top of this we usually refer to as gene regulatory network or transcriptional regulatory network. Then proteins interact with each other. They can phosphorylate each other, or they can bind to form protein complexes, so these kinds of interactions are usually represented as protein-protein interaction networks. And then another subset of proteins are enzymes, and they catalyze chemical reactions. So we have a whole another network, the metabolic or biochemical network, and the enzymes catalyze reactions, so they are coupled. And then chemicals from the environment, they interact with receptor proteins, and so they have a role in protein-protein interactions, or they form the signals or the starting points of the metabolic, the food for the metabolic network, so they couple to the metabolism as well. So there are a lot of possible networks that one can form, and ultimately all these networks are coupled to each other. So usually we talk about four different kinds of networks, and I refer to these just mention them. So in protein-protein interaction networks, we would define the nodes of the network that are the players as proteins, and the edges as protein-protein interactions, binding, for example, whatever can be measurable by yeast to hybrid or other high-throughput measurements. In signal transduction networks, the nodes are more diverse. They can be proteins or molecules. And the edges are also more diverse. They can be interactions like protein-protein interactions or chemical reactions. And what is common to them is that they have a directionality, and we could say that that directionality reflects information transfer. So there is a distinct sense of information transfer from the chemicals, the signals, the receptor proteins, and through the inside of the cell. There is also a lot of feedback. In metabolic networks, the nodes are metabolites and enzymes. Different representations focus on the metabolites or the enzymes. So there is a possible choice in here as well. But usually, one would need to represent both the metabolites and the enzymes as nodes of the network. And there are two types of edges that represent mass flow during the reaction and catalysis by the enzyme of the reaction. So this is one possible representation in which the enzyme-substrate complex is represented separately as an unnamed node. These are the reactants, these are the products, the reaction, this is the enzyme catalyzing the reaction. There are other possible representations as well. And in gene regulatory networks, again, there is a diversity, but I would say that the most complete representation would have two different types of nodes, separate nodes for the messenger RNA and the protein, and then we would have two types of edges. One is mass flow from the mRNA to the protein, and the other is more catalytic or regulatory from the protein to the mRNA of the genes that the protein is regulating. And this second regulatory edge can be positive or negative, activating or inhibiting. So all these networks have now experimental information available about them at different levels, and we can start to see how they look. And in the last 10 years, there has been an explosion of measurements of these interactions and an explosion of maps constructed. So for protein networks, we have maps for yeast, for a lot of prokaryotes, Drosophila, C. elegans, and parts of the human interactome. For transcriptional regulatory networks, the chip-chip technique is used. So we have maps for E. coli, yeast, parts of the sea urchin regulatory network. And signal transduction networks right now are curated manually. So there are no high-throughput methods yet to directly interrogate signal transduction networks. But there is now a large network of hundreds of nodes for signal transduction in a mammalian hippocampal neuron. So we have these maps, and we can analyze the topology of these maps, look at the structural properties, and some of the structural properties that have been looked at is whether or not the network is connected or strongly connected if it's directed. That is there a large portion of the network that can reach each other? Because that large connected component can tell us, in principle, how far a perturbation could propagate in that network. And it's very surprising that the protein interaction networks have large, giant connected components, so the majority of the proteins are connected to each other. Indirectly, of course. The path length, that is the distance on this connected component, is surprisingly small. It's usually around 2. And even in this signal transduction network, it's around 4. So the chain of reactions that's necessary for a perturbation to propagate anywhere else is less than 4, which is, again, surprisingly small. These networks are also heterogeneous in terms of lots of node properties. So one can look, for example, at the degree of a node, that is the number of edges, that's the number of interactions that a certain protein participates in, or other measures of centrality, importance. And there is a lot of variation in terms of these node properties, so that's what I call heterogeneous. So there are many nodes which have few edges, and then smaller amount of nodes which have more edges, and then a very small amount of nodes which have a huge number of edges. And also, it has been observed that in many of these networks, there are overexpressed interaction motifs, like the feed-forward loop, which you probably are familiar with. It's a three-node motif in which the first node is regulating the last node, the third node, both directly and indirectly to the second. So this is the feed-forward motif. Also feedback motifs, small cycles, and completely connected subgraphs in protein interaction networks, and so on. So there's a lot that one can do with analyzing the topology of these networks, and a lot has been done. But what I want to argue next is that's not enough. Ultimately, what we want is to understand the dynamics of these networks, what is happening in time. And what has been observed in a high-throughput manner is that only a subset of the possible interactions are actually active, happening in any given time or any given condition. So this paper looked at protein interaction networks and also what of these proteins are actually present at the same time. And they found that highly interactive proteins can be in one of two categories. In one category, all the interacting partners of the protein are also present at the same time, so they are all there to interact. And in another category, all these interacting partners were present in different conditions. So these proteins actually had a variety of conditions and few interacting partners present in any of those interacting conditions. And they call these party hubs and date hubs, respectively. So like in a party, you are all together, and in a date, you are going to date with several different individuals. And in this paper, they looked at transcriptional regulatory networks under different endogenous or exogenous conditions, and they again find that only a subset of the interactions are actually happening in any of those conditions. So we need to understand what is actually happening and present of all these possible interactions that has been so beautifully mapped. And so that means that network topology, who is interacting with whom or who can interact with whom, needs to be complemented of who is there and in what abundance. And I call this the state of the node. In most of the cases, you would think of a concentration as the state. But in some examples, you don't know the actual concentration. So some kind of variable telling you the state of the node is sufficient to try to start to address how these states change in time. And of course, then what we want is a dynamical description of how the states are changing in time or how are they changing under different conditions. And that, unfortunately, is only possible for a very small system, definitely not at the whole cell level. And there have been a lot of very beautiful success stories, and I think we have heard about a lot of them already. But I just mentioned a couple. So signal transduction in bacterial chemotaxis, the yeast cell cycle, the mammalian circadian clock, and all these examples that John and Albert have shown us. They are success stories in a quantitative dynamic description of a smaller subsystem. So what do we do when we have larger systems and we still want to have at least a rudimentary dynamic understanding? Well, my proposal, which is not too big of a surprise, is that the network of interactions forms the backbone of the process. We also need some kind of input and some kind of output or outcome that we want to look at. And then the network is telling us who interacts with whom and who can, in principle, change the state of whom else. So what we need a network, and we also need a description of the node states, and we need a description of the transfer functions. That is, when a node is regulating another node, what kind of function determines how the state of the regulated node is changing as a function of the state of the regulating node. If we put all this together, then for any given, if given an initial condition, or if given a boundary condition or a signal strength, the model can predict the outcome of the system or outcome of the dynamics of the system. So what do we need in detail? Well, we need a list of the components of the system, a list of the interactions, and some kind of description of the states of the components. And usually it's then the modeler's job to come up with hypotheses for the transfer functions, come up with guesses for the kinetics and for the parameters, and then putting everything together, that model needs to capture known behavior of the system. And after the model is validated, when it is shown to capture known behavior, then we can play around with it. So we can study cases that were not accessible experimentally. We can change parameters, change assumptions, and ultimately, we can gain insight into why complexity is necessary for that system. Why do we need so many different components and interactions to be able to generate that specific dynamical outcome? So what I will be telling you are examples of qualitative models. So models which are based on the assumption that knowing the regulatory network is more important than knowing the kinetic details of the individual interactions and of the transfer functions. And why do we want to make this assumption? Well, only out of necessity. It is usually more the network topology, the components and the interactions is usually more completely described as the kinetics and the transfer functions. So we try to go with what we know, and we try to have a simple qualitative description of what we don't know. We don't want to add a lot of complexity into the model when we don't know the actual roots of that complexity. So these qualitative models are based on the assumption that there is certain types of essential information. It is very important to know the inhibitors and take into account the inhibitors in some way. It's important to know whenever there is conditional activation, that is, a conditional or synergistic relationship between two different components that can activate a component. We need to know that, and we need to incorporate that. Also, if there is independent activity or independent activation, we need to incorporate the fact that that's independent. We need to incorporate decay in the component. And whenever possible and whenever known, we need to incorporate relative timing in some sense. So the simplest way of doing that is with a Boolean model, in which basically it is assumed that the state of the nodes can have one of two values, basically on or off. And the example that I will be showing you will be based on this Boolean representation of the state. So how do we go from a continuous to a Boolean to a qualitative representation? Well, usually, many of the regulatory relationships are represented with a differential equation like that. So let's assume that Y is a transcriptional regulator and X is the target gene. And we are representing the rate of synthesis of the target mRNA as a function of the concentration of the transcriptional regulator. There is a synthesis term and there is a free decay term. The free decay term has one unknown parameter, and the synthesis term has a number of parameters. And usually it is assumed to be a Hill function, so it's this nonlinear form. And as parameters we have this middle point, so the concentration of the regulator that corresponds to the half of the maximal rate of synthesis. The maximal rate of synthesis is another parameter, and the slope of this curve is another parameter. And the slope of the curve determines how fast the transition is, how sigmoidal the curve is, and when the slope is very large, this becomes very abrupt, very switch-like. So this, of course, this equation only represents one regulator-regulated node, and when there are many of them, usually some kind of combination of these nonlinear functions is used. So already with one interaction, we have four parameters, and these parameters are generally unknown. And of course, we have a lot of possible variability in coming up with these functions when there are more than one regulators. And of course, the number of parameters increases a lot. So when we don't know these parameters, but we have a sense that this switch is abrupt, so the sigmoidal is very steep, then we can make a huge simplification and basically say that what matters is whether or not the regulator is above or below a threshold. And this threshold could be this value corresponding to the half maximal activation. So we would say that if the concentration of the regulator is larger than this threshold, there will be production, synthesis of the regulated node, and if it's less, there will be no production. And then we can make another simplification and say that when there is production, then of course the production, we can assume that the production will outweigh the decay, so there will be net production. So it will be above a certain threshold at some point. And when there is no synthesis, but there is decay, because there is always decay, then the regulated node's concentration will decay to zero, so it will not be present at some point in the future. So we could represent all this differential equation with the Boolean rule. X in the future equals Y in the present. So the state of X in the future is regulated solely by the state of Y at the current time. You see, there is no explicit decay, but there is no need for explicit decay because we have the decay implicitly by the fact that X does not appear on the right-hand side. So because X, the current state of X does not influence the future state of X, that means that X is decaying if Y is not present. So that's the basic, the simplest Boolean representation. It has implicit thresholds in it, and so the off state means that the state is below the implicit threshold. The on state means that the state is above the implicit threshold, but the threshold is not stated. That makes it very simple and easy, but ultimately you want to have a feel for the thresholds in the real system. So this is the simplest that one can do, and usually it is also assumed that this future time is given as integer units or integer multiples of a time step. So these are the synchronous Boolean models when there is a clock, so to say. And so the states are looked at regular intervals, and there are a lot of possible variability to that. So we don't need to have synchronous update. We can have asynchronous update. We can look at the nodes to look at the future state of the nodes at different times, not just at multiples of one clock. We can also incorporate decay times and threshold durations. Like in this example, what we are saying is X, the current and the past state of X does influence the future state of X in this. And specifically, this is saying that even though Y is present, but if X was present for a certain amount of time, it will decay no matter what. So that's the incorporation of decay. And this is saying that Y needs to be present for a certain amount of time to be able to make X turn on. So there are possibilities of changing the simplest framework and also to introduce parameters. Also, a very nice hybrid approach assumes both a continuous variable and a discrete variable for each of the components in the system. The continuous variable you can think of as a concentration, and the discrete variable as an activity. Then the discrete variable is described by a differential equation. There is a free decay term in it.
Sorry, you mean the continuous variable?
Yes. Did I say discrete? Yeah. The continuous variable, yes, is described by a differential equation. But the synthesis term is a Boolean function, which is a function of the discrete variables of the nodes that regulate it. So its value is 0 or 1. So these are very simple differential equations. And then the discrete variables are determined from the continuous variables using a threshold. So if the continuous variable is below the threshold, then the discrete variable is 0 off. And when it's larger than the threshold, then the discrete variable is on. It's 1. So this framework is due to Leon Glass and Stuart Kaufman, 1973.
Right, yes. Is your X in the last line, is that the same as the Y in the line above?
No, but the same thing applies to Y as well. In principle, so this half is in the original formalism of Glass and Kaufman. In principle, that could be node intrinsic to each node. It could be a completely different parameter. So then X would have its own and Y would have its own. Also, this decay time doesn't need to be 1. It was 1 in the original formulation. But the same kind of thresholding applies to every discrete and every corresponding continuous variable. Okay, so these are the possibilities that one can do. The purest Boolean model doesn't have any parameters, and by this, I hope I have given you a couple of insights into how you can introduce parameters. And it makes sense to introduce parameters when you know something about the parameters. It doesn't make a lot of sense to introduce them if you don't know anything. So Yes. Yes, absolutely. Yes. So René Thomas and Stuart Kaufman were the originators of using Boolean models in general on gene regulatory networks, and their contributions were different and complementary and great. So what is new about the systems I will be showing you is that they are new models of specific biological systems based on specific biological information. There's nothing new in the formalism that I will be showing you. Yes.
So if you string some of these delayed together, you would get effectively a shift register.
Shift?
Between one thing and mm-hmm. shifts to the next.
Mm-hmm.
With a series of help, like storage elements, in fact.
Yes.
Put in one thing and then clock it through and it goes to the next.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yes, so if you have a chain of interactions, you are basically introducing delay, not more than that, yeah.
The feedbacks from one to the other, in electronics, that can give you a sort of a pseudo random noise generator.
Okay. Well, so in Boolean models, what's most frequently observed is oscillations when you have feedback. And so when you just look at the randomly put together Boolean network with randomly put together rules, you will have limit cycles most of the time and sometimes steady states. So that's kind of the most frequent, most expected behavior that you get. But you will see that in the models I will be showing you, there are not really no oscillations.
Richard, presumably the pseudo-random oscillations would need a specific encoding, right? You'd need...
Yeah, you have a specific encoding, then you check, you know, on an N cycle, you get, you make N especially large, and so how will some system work.
Right. But I guess in a biological network, there would be no particular reason to expect an encoding.
Well, you could get some sort of very interesting, fairly complex pattern very quickly.
Okay, so the first example will be a model of a gene regulatory network that plays a very important role in the segmentation of the Drosophila embryo. And the refinement and maintenance of the pair segments in the embryo. I will very briefly show you a continuous model of this process, and then a series of Boolean models. And I will mostly focus on the first one, and I hope that Madalena Chavez, who just arrived here, will be able to tell us about the second and third models, the much more realistic models. So all of these series of models, including the continuous and the discrete ones, reproduce the known gene expression patterns. And they explore changes in kinetic parameters. They explore knockout mutation changes in initial conditions. And the end conclusion is that the topology of this network is a main source of robustness. So the differentiation of the cells in the Drosophila embryo, and specifically this pattern of 14 parasegments, is due to gene regulation and to differential gene expression in different cells. And specifically, the cells just before the parasegment and the cell just after the parasegment have a very specific gene expression pattern. And in a little bit simplified way, you could say that one is expressing one segment priority gene called ingrailed, and the other is expressing a different one called wingless. And so the reason for the emergence and the maintenance of this phenotypic pattern is due to a refinement of gene expression. And the refinement of gene expression is happening in stages, in a hierarchy of different stages and different families of genes. So it all starts with maternal genes, and then there are the gap genes and the pair rule genes, and finally the segment priority genes. Each gene family is transcribed, regulated by the previous family. So they start with a certain initial condition. And the gene families in these three stages, they are made just once and then they decay. But the segment priority genes have a stable expression pattern for 3 hours. And they are given this pattern by the previous genes, but then they maintain this pattern by interactions among themselves, so by the network of interactions among them. So that is what we and others try to understand and model. So these are the segment variety genes, and of course we will not have time to familiarize ourselves with the names. These are their expression patterns. So it starts 2 hours and 50 minutes after fertilization of the egg, and you see that they start to be expressed in stripes, in columns of cells, as they are being first transcribed, regulated by the previous genes, and then they have 14 stripes 3 hours after fertilization, and they still have 14 stripes 7 hours after fertilization. So the basic pattern stays the same, or at least the relative pattern. And this pattern you could simplify and say that it's expressed in one cell or one column of cells, and then not expressed in three columns of cells, and then again in the fourth one, and so on. So it's a periodic four cell pattern for most of these genes, and it's a three cells on, fourth cell off for two of the segment variety genes. So we have these are our states. This is what the model needs to reproduce, and also a steady state with these patterns. Okay. So the continuous model, Fandas-Hauetor model, reconstructs the networks of the interactions in the following way. First, cell-to-cell interactions are important because wingless and hedgehog are two secreted proteins that lead the cells that they are expressed in. And they start basically whole signal transduction networks to regulate the transcription of engrailed. And in the case of hedgehog, hedgehog binds to PEST and forms a protein complex between them. There is transcriptional regulation involved. So everything that starts from a protein, which are these boxes, and ends in an mRNA, which are the ovals, that's transcriptional regulation. And what starts from an mRNA and ends in a protein, that's translation. And we have protein-protein interactions. This is a binding. This is more, again, a signal transduction type of catalytic reaction. Okay, so that's their representation of the network. And their representation of the transfer functions is continuous, nonlinear Hill type function. So this is a Hill function for one transcriptional activation. And when there's a combination between an activation and an inhibition, the function is like that. Basically, the activity of the activator is decreased by the activity of the inhibitor in a nonlinear way. They reduce this two-dimensional pattern into one-dimensional patterns for each of the involved mRNAs and proteins. So you will have these patterns, one-dimensional patterns, for each of them separately, and usually they, or all of them, have a four-cell period. There is a known initial condition for the pre-expression of these genes and proteins. And there's a known steady state, which is best represented like this. So this is experimentally known. And this is the model's best solution, best approximation of this as the outcome of the model. And it is very close. It's not identical. So if you notice, there's no pattern in patch hedgehog in the model, nor in patched. But it's really very close. So this is what they will call a solution. This is when the model generated a solution for the system. So they start from the known wild-type initial condition. They have 16 equations and 48 parameters. For these parameters, they know the orders of magnitude of the parameter region in which they can vary, but they don't know what exactly the value is. And the parameter regions are fairly large. So what they do is they randomly generate a set of parameters. They start from the initial condition, run the simulation until a steady state is reached. And then they use a threshold to decide whether the final pattern has that gene or protein on or off, because the target pattern is an on or off pattern. And they, if it is the wild-type pattern, they say that it is a possible solution. And then they generate a new parameter combination and so on. So what they find is that one in every 46 parameter combinations works. And these solutions can be anywhere in parameter space. They're not everywhere. Yes?
And always had trouble with this, you know, number, you know, 1 in 46 or 1 in 300.
Yes.
You know, how does one define a parameter space thing? Presumably, if I extend my parameter space, I don't know, by a factor of 2 in the region where it is saturated, mm-hmm. I'll come up with a different number.
Yes.
Aren't these numbers completely meaningless?
Well, I wouldn't say. I mean, I don't think that the numbers have an importance per se, and I agree that there are variabilities in the numbers. So the way I understand is they biologically restricted parameter space, and of course it's also
sampled only at a certain rate.
Yes. So 1 in every 46, that's the best number that they reported, and they have 1 in 200 as well. I think what's important for me is the fact that these possible solutions do not form clusters in parameter space. They can be anywhere. And I think this is, or this was the most important for me about their paper, because it suggests, and they are making this suggestion, that it's not the fine-tuning of the parameters that matters, but the underlying topology. So this is what we took from this paper. And then said, if the parameters don't matter, then maybe we don't need any parameters. Let's see how a model without parameters could work. So we went back to the literature and reconstructed our own version of the network topology, which is a little bit different, not crucially, but a little bit different than theirs. And then we formulated a Boolean model, synchronous Boolean model at the beginning. So basically saying that everything is either on or off, and everything is a simple logical combination, a Boolean function of its regulators. So transcriptional regulation, if the transcriptional activator is present, the transcription will happen, the mRNA will be present in the next step. If there's a transcriptional repressor present, the transcription will not happen, there will be no mRNA. If the transcriptional activator is not present because it decayed, then the mRNA will also decay, and so on. We, in the synchronous model, we assumed that transcription, translation, decay of the mRNA, decay of the protein is approximately on the same time scale. We have another faster time scale, which we assume that's instantaneous, and that corresponds to protein binding. And the asynchronous update, this assumption of a common time scale is relaxed. Anything, so everything can have different time scales with one consistent condition, and that is that post-translational processes to be faster than pre-translational processes. And that's a very realistic assumption. And everything can vary otherwise. So these are examples of the Boolean rules that we used. It's probably not too difficult to understand. So these are the simplest for translation. The protein is only governed by the mRNA, and for transcription, the transcriptional regulators matter. So for example, for hedgehog, Ingrid activates it, cubitus represses it, so we need the activator to be present and the repressor to not be present in order for the transcription to take place. And similar rules for all the other nodes. Okay, I will skip this. So we know the initial condition for these genes. We now have our rules, and we can look at the steady state. And the steady state that we find after iterating the rules a couple of times is a very good description of what is actually known experimentally. It is really a good representation of the normal wild-type steady state of the system. So what that is saying is that the net effect of the interactions and some reasonable assumptions of timing are sufficient to generate the correct steady state of this system. We can also look at what happens in knockout mutations. So basically we can say what are necessary components of this system. So if we knock winglets out, it doesn't matter what the initial condition of the other genes is, the steady state is always this one, a state without any pattern. And that is a known lethal phenotype. The same thing happens when we knock hedgehog or ingrid, two other genes. On the other hand, in another knockout of BASH, we do see a pattern that's actually wider than normal. That, again, doesn't depend on the initial conditions. And in a knockout of cubitus, we actually do see the correct pattern for three of the different genes and their corresponding proteins. And these are, in fact, experimentally known. So these are, I wouldn't say they are predictions. Our model generated them independently, but the experiments were present. So we can compare what the model says and what the experimental patterns are. So,
sorry, yes. A question. I was a little confused by the initial conditions here. Mm-hmm. You're starting from the free pattern that you would expect from the Peru genes or from an arbitrary free pattern?
From what you would expect from the variable genes, yes. We only have the transcripts in the pre-pattern. We don't pre-pattern the proteins, saying that they are probably...
So it would be similar to the initial condition that would have been used by von Dassermann.
Yes, yes.
What is the variation with respect to changes in the initial condition?
We have looked at that. There is... So when you look at the wild-type steady state, there's... In numbers, there's a very large number of initial conditions that can still lead to that steady state. While relatively speaking, it's not so large because the number of possible patterns is also very large. So, yeah, I actually have a slide on that. So it's 10 to the negative 6 of all the possible initial conditions. So it's not so large. The largest basin of attraction is actually corresponds to a to this pattern, which is also very similar to the pattern which is obtained where Pesh is knocked out. Actually, about 90% of the initial conditions go to this pattern.
And what is the attractor in the other initial conditions? I mean,
are there any different ones? No, these are all the possible attractors.
This is for the wild type?
Yes, but the mutants are also very similar to this. So the mutant attractors cannot be identical to wild-type attractors because the knockout gene is missing. But if you forget about that, then these are all the patterns. There are some very small variants of these four patterns which represent themselves as small variations in one pattern. So if you disregard that, then these are the four possible steady states in the system and four possible attractors because there are no oscillations that we could see. We tried 2 and 3.
You searched all initial conditions?
No, we sampled initial conditions.
Yes. You see that? 90% go to a little steady state. How does the system?
It's 90% go to this broad steady state, and a fairly large number go actually to the little steady state because it turns out that you need to have something for wingless in the initial condition. You cannot not have any wingless in the initial condition. If you have nothing for wingless, you will go to this steady state.
So bias the system to go to the appropriate steady state.
The network topology. I cannot pinpoint it exactly, but I can tell you something about it. There is a positive feedback loop between ingrained and wingless in neighboring cells, and you need that to function. And so you can initiate it with having wingless, for example, and then everything will fall into place. But if you don't have wingless, then you're in big trouble, and then that positive feedback loop cannot initiate, and then this will be the final pattern. Yes.
I somehow missed exactly what's happening in space. So you basically have a one-dimensional cellular array, and you're looking for periodic pattern with what, alternating expression?
A periodic four-cell pattern. There's
in wingless.
So in wingless, we need three cells off, four cells on. And this is actually what we are starting from because that's what biologically is happening. They maintain the pattern that they started from. Yeah. But then
so
also...
Actually, in the embryo, it's really five cells that...
Four cells, yes, when they are initiated. And then during the development, there will be also cell divisions. And we have included cell division in one variant of the model, and that also gives the correct pattern. So in later stages, there will be 8 cells and then 12 cells per segment. But for a fairly long time, it's 4 cells.
Yeah, no, there are boundaries there, they're sharp, but the cell pattern is not even ordered. fact, it's not given a regular lattice, so it's fluctuating. So somehow, you know, the number 4 can't be, or 12 for that matter, can't be the.
Mm-hmm. It's flat. Yeah. It's of course, it's and not a magic number.
Which, you know, I guess my question is, should we be thinking of this as, you know, a spatial period, or should we be thinking of this as an array of the main walls?
But it's the precondition is already setting the scale.
Well, I understand, but right. So I guess what I want to understand is the model fundamentally, you know, what should the model do? Should it really define the wavelength as I don't know, Turing instability obviously doesn't apply here, but that's an example where there's spatial instability and it spits out spatial oscillation, right? Alternatively, I can imagine a situation where I have bistability and stable domain walls. And I can put the domain wall anywhere I want. In particular, I can put the domain wall somewhere by the initial condition, which is what you're doing anyway.
Yes.
So should we be talking about the spatial period, or should we just be talking about a model which will give you a nice sharp domain wall?
Well, it's the second, definitely. And it's maybe even less than the second, because we don't want any space doesn't really play a role here. Space does not change, let me say. So we have an initial periodicity, and that is maintained, basically. There is.
Morris's question, what would happen if you started with an initial condition of Lewis and Grail where you had 4 off and the fifth one off, or 4 off and the fifth one off? So a different spatial.
Yeah, that would.
Would it maintain the.
Yes, it would. It would. It would maintain the periodicity.
Or even simpler. If you just I'm actually a little fuzzy on what the domain should be. Just an interface between gray and black, or maybe just sort of a single sort of soliton type thing of black, and then the model all it basically has to do is keep that stable. The condition that you would want is that you can now put 2 such solitons at the main walls. Not too close together, and they won't interact, right? Some locality. And then you think that there should be a very large class of such models, and the convergence should be pretty independent of initial conditions. I guess this business of 1 million initial conditions going there is...
There are models of this, newer models of this system, which only look at single cells, and they say that single cell is receiving some kind of input, and then it will have some kind of steady state. So in that sense, it's not necessary to have domain walls as well.
It can be single cells, because they're signaling to each other.
Yes, so that's what I was...
Single interfaces, if you like, between the two, why is it not just bistability?
It is, I think, it is by stability. But so I think you should not. So although these cells are separable, if given the correct conditions, in addition to the initial condition that we have, what we wanted to see in this case is, if given the known components and known interactions, what kind of model is necessary to give the correct steady state when started from the correct initial condition? So our goal was not to generate the pattern, but to see what kind of complexity of model transfer functions we need to describe the system. Yeah.
Okay, so in relation to the question now, so in your model, there is no diffusion, right?
There are cell-to-cell interactions in Wingless and Hedgehog, but there is no diffusion.
Interesting property of development is resistance for the perturbation development process. In your model, I agree, with a certain initial condition, you can read to the one-time parameter. Have you checked through, let's say, resistance to the perturbation during the process? It might require some kind of Turing type, when you say, system, or this point to say that have you checked such kind of direction that you reserve?
I see what you mean. In some sense, we did that by looking at the different initial conditions. We did not look at single perturbations, like when just on the expression of something in one cell would be initiated wrong. But I think because our results were so strong in terms of looking at different initial conditions, my prediction is that there would be a huge amount of robustness to just changing one thing. And one question we did ask is, what's the minimum amount of free pattern necessary to find the final steady states? And we find that it's only two genes in two cells. Everything else can be completely missing. And you still find the correct pattern. So there is a large robustness in the system to perturbations than transient.
So I don't want to cut off the debate at all, because I have a dozen questions myself, but I think we should meet this afternoon and hash some of this out. This is really interesting stuff that really has lots of questions. So how about we meet at 2:30 or something like that in a small seminar room? Anybody who's interested? I'll be there for sure.
Sure. And while another complimentary suggestion is that, so this these issues that I told you here are properties of the simplest model, and then there are also the two other versions, more complicated versions of this model. So I think there will be opportunity for further discussion if Madalena gets to talk about the other two. Okay, so would you like me to stop now, or you?
No.
Okay. All right. So I will skip this then, and go to this model of the signal transduction network. So I was fortunate to have Sally Aspen as a collaborator, who's a plant biologist, and who's an expert on this process of abscisic acid-induced closure of stomata in the leaves of plants. So the stomata are pores, basically, and the size of the pores are determined by the size and shape of two cells called guard cells. So when the guard cells are full of water, they are inflated, then the pores are largest, and when the guard cells deflate by losing water, then the pores are smallest. So the pore is basically a hole. And so these are the pores through which the plant breathes and takes up carbon dioxide with photosynthesis. There has been, of course, a lot of interest in this process and how this process is regulated and what participates in the process. And throughout the years, I think about two decades, I believe, more than 20 different components were implicated in the process. And Sally said that it's now impossible to write a comprehensive review article of everything that's included in this process, so one really needs a network. So that's where she asked for my interest and collaboration, and I was happy to be able to help in this. So the first thing that we needed to do is to infer the network. Try to come up with what is the network based on, as you will see, very indirect experimental evidence. And then, again, because there is almost nothing known about kinetics and transfer functions, we assume that everything works in a switch-like manner. So we have a Boolean model for this system. And with this model, we were able to reproduce the system's correct behavior and also disrupted behavior. And we looked at disruptions, changes in initial conditions, changes in timing. And again, one of the big insights is that a lot of variability doesn't matter in this system. Even a lot of perturbations don't matter at all. There is still a robust response. And we identify the critical perturbations that do matter. Okay. So, the process is ABA-induced closure. ABA is a hormone. When there is no moisture in the soil, then the plant itself makes this hormone. And it travels up the roots and up the plants to the leaves. It's unknown, really, what the local concentration of ABA is. But it's known that ABA is starting the process of closure of stomata. So the stomata usually respond to light and carbon dioxide and other environmental conditions. But when there is drought and when ABA is produced, then the plant decouples the stomata from the environment and basically closes them, and it inhibits their opening to light, which they usually would do. So we know the starting point of the process, ABA. We know the end point of the process, closure or big decrease of the stomatal apertures. And there are a large number of components involved in some sense in this process. So why do I say involved in some sense? Well, what they can do experimentally is they can knock out or disrupt those components and then see the effect on the whole process. So by this, they know that the depolarization of the membrane of the cell has a positive role in this process, because if they don't let the membrane to depolarize, the process doesn't happen or it's much decreased. Or they know that potassium efflux plays a positive role in this process, because if they don't let potassium to flow out of the cell, then they will not see the same effect as normally. They know that ABI, the protein ABI1, has a negative role in the process, because in the ABI knockout mutant, the pores are more sensitive to ABA, and so on. So this is causal evidence, definitely, but indirect evidence, and not interaction evidence. So we need to put together this kind of causal indirect evidence to come up with a putative network. So our hypothesis was that whenever there is an indirect evidence of this kind, zincosine kinase has a positive effect in ABA-induced closure. So that's the word description of this indirect three-node inference. Then what we can say that there must exist two intersecting paths in the unknown interaction network. There must be a path, of course, between ABA and closure. There must be a path between zincosine kinase and closure, and these two paths must intersect each other. So in every case when we had an inference like this, we assume that there are these two paths which intersect each other at as of yet unknown point. So we collected all the evidence from the literature. We put together a table like this. And then we proceeded to disentangle these pieces. So that's what I told you about. So whenever there is this positive or negative regulatory role, we assumed that there is an as of yet unknown component where these two paths intersect. We call that intermediary node. And then whenever there was more evidence, we tried to collapse these intermediary nodes to identify them with known nodes. Basically, its neighbors in the chain, either A or B or C. For example, if we know these two intersecting paths, but then we also know that A directly activates C, then the simplest explanation is that C itself is the mediator. Of course, this may not be the case at all. It's just the simplest and most parsimonious representation of these two pieces of evidence together. We didn't want to have more redundancy in the network than necessary, so our idea was to come up with the most parsimonious network and then make changes to it whenever necessary, whenever there is more evidence. So we did this by hand, so for each of these interactions, thinking about it and so on, but then it turns out that this is computationally a very interesting problem, and it's related to transitive reduction. It's actually a binary transitive reduction with critical edges, and I was fortunate to inspire a group of computer scientists who now have an implementation of this algorithm. So basically, what is the main output of this is that we wanted to have chains whenever possible. And this is the network, how it ended up being after collecting all the evidence. So the beginning is ABA, the hormone, and the end point, the output of the network, is an abstract node for closure. And what happens in between is a lot of ion flows. This is potassium ions, other anions, calcium, depolarization of the membrane, and everything that's regulating these ion flows. So calcium plays a very important role, and it's a big part of this network. So we have calcium-induced calcium release from stores. This stands for the calcium release from stores, and we have the inositol components here. We have IP3 and IP6 as well. We have calcium flow through the membrane as regulated by a reactive oxygen species, so that's the calcium flow through the membrane. We have the positive loops for the calcium-induced calcium release in this part. We also have, on this side of the network, we have increase in the cytosolic pH levels and the regulation of that. We have G proteins. In general, the green ones are signal transduction proteins, the red ones are enzymes, the orange ones are molecules, and the blue nodes are transport related. So we have this network, and one thing that you can see is that there are a lot of alternative paths between the same input and the same output, and some of them are completely independent of each other. So that is already suggesting that there is a large robustness, possible robustness in the system, because if you disrupt one path, the other path still could function. And when just analyzing the topology of the network and the chains of interactions and the distances, one could come up with the prediction that actually the minimum amount of nodes that need to be disrupted to not have any connection between beginning and end is 4. So just topological analysis is telling us that there is a large robustness. But the big question is, are all these different pathways independent of each other? And they are, in fact, not independent. So we need a dynamic model to incorporate the fact that some of them are conditionally dependent on each other. For example, we need both the reorganization of the actin cytoskeleton, which is it's a little described path, but it nevertheless is there. So we need both that and ion flows in order for the water to flow out of cells. So there is definitely synergy between this red path and the blue paths here. So we need to incorporate that to have a better understanding of the real robustness of the system.
Can you quickly, are the dots unknown
things? Yes, those are the unknown things. And so all of these, we know in all of these cases that these, without the dots, those would not be interactions. Those are all pathways, and there is at least one unknown component there. So those are all possible predictions of unknown components. Yeah.
So is the statement that it would take 4 mutations to get rid of the
Yes. Yes. Just from topological analysis, just from the path. Yes. Yes, there are.
How often that anybody mutates 4 things?
Yes, they are only mutated one by one, and they are not. So usually in this system, these experimental disruptions are more deactivation of proteins, not mutations per se. And it's nobody has ever looked at 4, and in some cases it is known that disrupting one already has a large effect. So definitely
that's what I'm asking. So
yes, so that's not correct.
Single mutations are disrupted.
Yes, so. Definitely that topological prediction that 4 needs to be disrupted is not correct, so that's why we need to go further.
So a quick question about the ion channels. They're either on or off. Is that how you model them?
Yes, that's how we model them, yes. And everything else, in fact. So we are not specifically saying that everything is either on or off, but the way you can think about it is that there is enough or not enough of them. Okay, so the model again is a Boolean model. The rules will be described as Boolean rules. And for example, in the case of closure, we said that potassium flow through either of the 2 potassium channels and anion flow through the anion channel and the reorganization of the actin cytoskeleton and a low concentration of the organic anion malate is necessary for effective closure. So we do incorporate a lot of synergy when there is experimental evidence for synergy.
This is with synchronous update?
No, it's asynchronous update. And because we don't know anything about the timing, we tried every possible update. So we are sampling over update times. And also we are sampling over initial conditions as well. So our results will take kind of a frequency or probabilistic view. We are basically simulating a lot of replicate stomata, and we are looking at what fraction of the population is showing the correct output of closure.
Thank you.
What differs between the replicates and the initial
condition? The initial condition and the order of update, basically the relative timing. So we are sampling over relative timings uniformly randomly. So we still have time steps in the model, and these time steps correspond to the maximum delay between two components. So everything will be updated before the maximum. And so this time step also corresponds to a round of update. We assume that nothing is updated twice while one is updated once. So with that restriction, the time scales can be different. So for example, in an initial condition when ABA is constantly on, so when the signal is there, we don't set a random initial condition for the output node closure. So that starts from zero, that's off. So the frequency of the simulations that have closure in the on state starts with zero and then it increases in time. And by 8 steps, every replicate simulation reaches the correct state. So it doesn't matter what the initial condition is, doesn't matter what the time scales are, every model stomata will reach closure when its signal is on. On the other hand, when we don't have the signal, or because of our random initial conditions, there is still activation going on in the system, but that will decay in time, and of course, there will be no response.
Is there a known dose response for how closure is affected?
There are a few time points known, and not time points, sorry, concentration levels. But usually, those are very variable, so people kind of have a feeling for what's the concentration of ABA necessary for a robust response, and that's what they use. So unfortunately, there is little known about the dose response, because if we knew the dose response, then I would have a feel of how sigmoidal it is. But it's usually 3 points. And so these experiments are also done with the concentration of ABA necessary for a normal response, and then they look at the disruptive
these
cases.
Are these intact plants, or are there cell lines in which this can be done?
Peels, usually. So these are, they take off the epidermis of plants, and that's alive for about 2 hours.
So it's like an explant.
Yes, and they put it into a concentration, into a solution in which there is a certain concentration of ABA. They are also trying it to do on whole leaves, and some people are able to do it in whole plants, but that's much more difficult. There are no cell lines, unfortunately, and you know you cannot separate the guard cells from the epidermal cells. Okay. Yes.
And this process is all under circadian clock.
It is, so it's very important that you do the experiments at the same time, and you know, usually in the same window. So that's there's a lot of variability.
So what's the time scale for closure from application?
30 minutes.
So it's pretty fast.
Yeah, and so some of the time scales are actually much faster than that, but there is very little information. So again, 30 minutes are used to make sure that everything that was supposed to close is closed. Okay, so of course in this model we can simulate knockouts very easily. We just say that component is off, and then everything that's solely modulated by it or synergistically modulated by it will be off. But the question is that sufficient to have a big effect on our output node closure, because that's what we are looking for. And many of them are not sufficient. So these are the possible behaviors that we see in the model. This is the normal response. And in 65% of the possible perturbations, single node perturbations, this is the response that we see at this population level. So it seems that there is no difference in this simulated time course. In some cases, we actually see a faster response, and specifically when we disrupt the inhibitor node, ABI1, and that's experimentally known that those the guard cells of those plants are more sensitive to ABA. So that's, in a sense, it's a reproduction of known experimental results. In 3 perturbations, we see no response at all. And those are either experimentally known or there are very good hints to that effect. So 3 single components alone individually can completely knock out the system. So the topology-based prediction was not correct. It was too relaxed. In some cases, we see a partial response. And how is that possible? Actually, the subsets of, well, no, every cell in the population is fluctuating between the on and off state. And the sum of the simulations in which the cell is, or the closure is on, interestingly enough, stays constant or approximately constant. But every cell is fluctuating on and off. And why is there? Well, they are driven by the calcium oscillations. So this we see in five more cases. And in, I think, five more cases, we see the same steady state, well, closure, but with a larger time scale. So there is a slower approach to the same steady state. And this is everything that we can see. And interestingly enough, calcium perturbation is in this category. So it says that although calcium, if we don't let calcium to increase or decrease, or you know, we just fix calcium, this is the behavior that we will see. On the other hand, if we fix pH levels, the pH levels, this is so a more severe defect that we will see. So that was very surprising to us, and it was very surprising to others as well. So we had to test that experimentally. So what you see is these are experimental histograms of the aperture of stomata. There is a variability. Of course, there is always variability in biological systems. So this dark gray histogram corresponds to open stomata, stomata which did not receive any ABA. And this light gray corresponds to stomata which received a high saturating concentration of ABA. And there is an overlap between them, so that's this intermediary gray. So for those stomata, you cannot tell whether they are open or closed. What we can tell is we can disrupt calcium or we can disrupt VH and see what happens to these two populations. The populations of stomata which did not receive the signal and the populations which did receive the signal. And so that's how we can quantify the severity of the defect. So the dark gray populations don't seem to be changing much. Those are the stomata which did not receive a signal, although we have disrupted calcium in this case and we have disrupted pH in this case. So that means that these cells are alive and they are doing what they are supposed to do.
How are you disrupting calcium?
BAFTA. So we just don't let it change. So it's BAFTA, and for this one, butyrate, I believe. Okay. So these are added to the solution, and they don't seem to change or pH to change. Okay. On the other hand, the light gray histograms are moving to the right, both of them. And so the basis for comparison is how much to the right, and how much do they overlap with the population which did not receive the signal? Because if they overlap completely, that means that the signal didn't matter. The signal was knocked out efficiently. So in this case, you see there is a large overlap between them, but there are also regions which are not overlapping, and this is the case of calcium, while in this case, the overlap is almost perfect, and statistically, in fact, these two distributions are statistically indistinguishable. So disrupting pH did have a larger effect than disrupting calcium. So in this little bit abstract sense, our prediction was verified experimentally. And I don't think I will talk about the third example. Do I? Okay. So again, along the same lines of how detailed the model needs to be in order to be able to give some predictions and some new biological insights. We started collaborating with Eric Harville and his lab to model the interactions among bacteria and the immune system of mammals. So we used actually two different pathogens which cause respiratory infections on mice, and we we try to reproduce the most important steps in the immune response and in what the bacteria are doing to counteract the immune response. The model is a Boolean model with some parameters now. We have finite decay times. And we compared with experiments, and we tried to restrict our parameters based on what is known experimentally, and we tried to make new predictions and verify some of those predictions. So the immune response is based on the activity of certain very important cells. Some of these cells, like neutrophils and macrophages, are phagocytes in the bacteria, basically ingesting and killing the bacteria. Other cells are producing chemicals that alert these phagocytes to the presence of bacteria. And other cells are producing antibodies which bind to the bacteria and, again, alert the phagocytes to come and ingest those bacteria. So the cell types that we definitely need to include are neutrophils, macrophages, T cells, and B cells. T cells come in two flavors, T helper 1 cells and T helper 2 cells, and they seem to have different roles. And the T helper 2 cells are the ones that activate the B cells, and B cells produce antibodies which bind to the bacteria. And then there are a set of very important chemicals, cytokines and chemokines, that activate the phagocytic cells. Now, the immune system has two big branches. One is the innate immunity, which are innate and general mechanisms, so not pathogen-specific mechanisms. And the adaptive immunity is pathogen-specific and based on memory. And there is a positive feedback between the innate and adaptive immunity, so we wanted our model to reflect that. So putting everything together, again, saying that nodes are either cells or chemicals, basically everything that's a player in the system. And the edges now processes in general in which one player is activating or repressing another player. This is a network representation that we came up with. So the bacteria are the source or the input of this system. And the outcome is phagocytosis of the bacteria, which of course feeds back to clear the bacteria. And phagocytosis needs cells, of course, the activated phagocytic cells. And these cells are activated by three different mechanisms. First, so the activated phagocytic cells, of course, they first need to be recruited. So we have a separate node for the recruited cells, which come from other places to the site of infection. And then these two mechanisms are mechanism of activating or priming these recruited cells. And this part, the complement-based, is innate immunity-based. And this part is adaptive immunity-based. So there are two different ways to activate the cells. And actually, the adaptive immunity is based on the feedback from the innate immunity. So these two different activations are reinforcing each other. There is an interesting double negative feedback loop between the two different kinds of T cells, which, as we will see, the bacteria try to modulate. So this is the immune system where the bacteria are only present as sources, as the trigger. But then the different bacteria are trying to counteract different components. So one type of bacterium that we looked at, Buratella bronchiseptica, has a type 3 secretion system in which it has like small needles in which it injects some chemicals into the cells and basically kills the cells. So that's why we have a new node called dead BMNs, dead cells. But these dead cells...
What are BMNs?
Polymorphonuclear leukocytes. Basically, they are neutrophils and...
progenitor cells.
Yes. In our system, they are mostly neutrophils. Yes.
What is complement?
Complement is... that's a different good question. I think it's a kind of protein. But what is... So it's part of the very first line of defense. I believe it is a protein, or if not a protein, then a chemical, which, again, it binds to bacteria and makes the bacteria more visible to the cells that ingest bacteria. And it's a very generic and innate part of the response. Complement also, so some antibodies can bind to the complement, and then the complement and the antibodies together are much more effective. But you can complement can work alone as well. Okay, so bronchoseptica also, it seems there is experimental evidence, although there is no mechanism, it modulates this balance between the Th1 and Th2 cells. And our second pathogen, which we looked at, Bordetella pertussis, secretes the pertussis toxin, which does not slows down a lot the recruitment of the neutrophils. And also by two other proteins and by an unknown mechanism, it also modulates the balance between Th1 and Th2 cells. So we have two different models for the two different pathogens, although they are similar to each other, but the specific aspects of what...
So your notes here are sometimes cells and sometimes proteins.
Yes. Yes, there is a large variability. And let's see if there's anything more than that. Yeah, well, sometimes cells, sometimes proteins. That's pretty much it, yeah.
And phagocytosis?
Well, phagocytosis is a complex. It's a concept, yeah. In fact, you know, we don't necessarily need this specifically. We could say that the activated phagocytic cells are inhibiting or decreasing the amount of bacteria. So in some sense, this is more to...
But you introduce a delay, as it were, right?
Yes, we do. Yes, we do introduce a delay. And I think a delay like that is realistic. You know. Also, this activated phagocytic cells is another state of the same cells, so that is also a delay. But then the delay would be the delay necessary to activate those cells. Okay. So again, we start from the initial condition in which the bacteria are on, everything else is off. And they start to turn on one by one, and we have this representation now. So these are time courses for different components, and this is for bacteria. And when you see these orange boxes, that means that there are still bacteria present, and at this time point, they are cleared, there are no more bacteria. And then you can see the activation of the different parts of the immune system. So these are pro-inflammatory cytokines, yes.
Sorry, Erica, I was just wondering where the experimental data comes from here. This is from mice?
Yes, the experimental data comes from mice. And mostly, the only output that they look at is bacterial numbers.
And what they're taking blood samples at different times and they're testing for bacteria?
In fact, they are killing the mice.
So each time point is a dead mouse?
Yes. Several, actually, three usually. So that's one of the reasons why there aren't that many experiments and there isn't that many replicates as well either. So when they kill the mouse, then they usually look at lung homogenates. Basically, they take the whole lung. They look at bacterial numbers. They can also look at cell numbers as well, but for some reason they do that less frequently. So most of the information comes in the form of time courses for bacterial numbers in the lung. So this is the time course that we work with. So starting from this initial condition, about 10 to the fifth bacterial colony forming units, the bacterial numbers increase for a while. They actually, at the beginning, they increase exponentially when the immune system is not working yet.
Yes. A question, just to follow up.
Mm-hmm.
If you infect mice with that particular strain, presumably, mm-hmm. one of these bacteria, what's the variation in time to death? I mean, I'm mm-hmm. trying to understand what the level of mouse-to-mouse variation
mm-hmm. is. It's not too large. So these error bars stand for the three different. It's usually three mice, sometimes four, not too much. So the error bars are not as large. There is definitely variability, and in the strains which do die, they die between 6 days and 8 days.
Mm-hmm. And that's pretty much 100% for these?
Yes, yes. But these, so the cases that we looked at, or that we are monitoring, in this case actually, but the bacteria are cleared. And another problem is that you see these time points are really far from each other. So they look at the first 3 days, but then they look weekly and then bi-weekly. So we cannot really pinpoint whether clearance happens here at day 70 or at sometimes after day 40, whatever. So we don't know that much. But, you know, they kind of do the detail, or they do it close enough. When they find that weekly is not sufficient, then they go a little bit closer. But in each case, it's a difficult decision because it's 10 more mice. So this is a generic form. I think it's variations are possible, but so what people would say is that the bacteria increase for about a week and then they start to decrease and then there is clearance. They would report it at day 70 in this case, but it's sometimes somewhere here in this region. So this is for bronchiseptica, and for Bordetella pertussis, the clearance is faster, so around day 45. So this is what, in a simplified way, our model is reproducing. We're trying to reproduce. And so the different immune components, there is experimental evidence, and whenever there was something quantitative, we try to incorporate that in our parameters. Sometimes it's just known that, for example, there are two waves of neutrophils, recruited neutrophils. The innate immunity is recruiting one wave of neutrophils, and then there is another wave during adaptive immunity. And the same for pro-inflammatory cytokines as well.
What is faster in the response?
Again, we cannot pinpoint one thing about it, but let me try to. Yes, I think probably the most important difference is the switch between Th1 and Th2 responses. So the time when Th2 responses are activating B cells and antibodies are starting to be produced is earlier in pertussis. Okay. So our model is reproducing pretty much what is happening in a normal case, so we can use it to look at other cases. And one case that we looked at, not as a prediction because there was experimental information about it, is what happens if we pre-condition the system with antibodies. So the immune system doesn't need to make the antibodies because we are already giving the antibodies to them in the form of immune serum. And in that case, Bordetella bronchiseptica, according to the model, is cleared very fast, while Bordetella pertussis takes the same amount of time as normally. So it doesn't matter for Bordetella pertussis, according to the model, so that the antibodies were already there.
Sorry, I'm confused. How are you putting into the model the difference between these two bacteria? Where does that appear?
In the node-specific aspects. In the bacteria-specific aspect. Because our rules are not exactly the same because the bacteria are doing different things to counteract the immune system. So we have the type 3 secretion system for one, we don't have a type 3 secretion system, we have a pertussis toxin for the other. Also, some of these parameters that I didn't tell you very much about, but we do have parameters for decay for the different cytokines and different immune components that are also different in the two bacteria. That's based on experiments. So this is a pretty surprising, well, it would be surprising, it's a pretty strong result. So antibodies do not seem to matter for one of the two bacteria, and they are in fact true experimentally. So when you look at the bacteria curves, this is what you should be looking at. So there is clearance of the bacteria in 3 days, in one. Unfortunately, this time course only goes to day 7. There is no clearance, so these curves are showing the fact that the two curves are the same. One is immune serum, and the other is a control. So in 7 days, there is no effect of antibodies. There will be an effect later, So it's not, I mean, I wouldn't say that the time course is exactly the same as in the wild type, but definitely in the first 7 days, there is no effect of the antibodies.
Shouldn't there be antigen-antibody complex in the pertussis from the beginning? Because you're giving them antibodies.
A good point, yeah. I'm trying to think. Yes, that must be a mistake. You're absolutely right, there should be. Yeah, well, it's possible that this is an accidental duplication because I don't see any difference. But it's a specific antibody. It's not an antibody against Bronchi septica. Yeah. So yeah, forgive me for this. We did not make a mistake in a paper. I made probably a mistake in including this figure. The time course or the time point is the same when even with antibodies. But I will double check in the paper.
Is there some
yes, yes. Borrelia pertussis is making the pertussis toxin that's not letting the cells to come in. Although the antibodies are present, the antibodies are a mechanism to prime those cells, to make the cells target the bacteria. But if the cells are not present, it doesn't matter that the antibodies are there. You know, the real players are not there because pertussis is not letting them. And that takes about 14 days. So while in Bordetella bronchi septica, the cells are there a day later, in pertussis they can only come 2 weeks later. We also looked at reinfection of convalescent hosts. So mice which already went through a disease and now they are recovering, but still parts of their immune system and immune memory are still active. These mice are infected again, and experimentally these mice are infected in the 50th day of their previous infection. And this is now a prediction which we tested experimentally. And the prediction is now not showing differences between the two pathogens. Both of them will be cleared faster, and they are in fact cleared faster. So the second infection is cleared much faster than an infection of a naive host. And of course, our model has a lot of other predictions. We tested these two of them. So what I was trying to show you with these examples is that it's possible to gather complex experimental information about interaction networks and then come up with simple ways, parsimonious ways of modeling them, and these models can be predictive and the predictions can be tested, sometimes validated and sometimes invalidated. But it's definitely it's a starting point. And we don't necessarily need to wait until a lot of kinetic evidence is there to start modeling and start being useful.
Sometimes when you have continuous treatment by differential equations, you see that the Hill coefficient is important for determining the qualitative dynamics. Mm-hmm. And here you make the assumption that everything is really infinitely cooperative.
Absolutely, yes.
So did you try to look at versions of these models where you have a kind of sigmoidal, smooth sigmoidal mm-hmm. function rather than a step function? See whether it affects mm-hmm.
No, we didn't try to do that ourselves. We have a previous example of the von Dassel model with compared to ours. So my feeling is that there would be differences. But you know,
you're using that for quantitative aspects also, right? You make quantitative predictions.
Yes, they are a little bit less quantitative. And in some sense, let me try to think. Yeah, so we did not try specifically that. And I'm not saying that there wouldn't be any effects in for something to be more continuous. I guess my point is that if you don't know actually what how sigmoidal it is, then it's, yeah.
But isn't there a broader question here, I think, about whether taking a continuous dynamical system and discretizing it, how much information is preserved? I mean, to what extent does the discrete system reproduce or mess the behavior of the continuous system. And I think both Stuart Kaufman and René Thoma approached this question, and there were certainly some results of, you know, if you take particular kinds of continuous systems and discretize them in a certain way, then you can, you know, faithfully recapture some of the dynamics. And I think, but I was going to ask, do you know what the kind of best known, you know, so what were the strongest results about this mathematical question? Because it's very relevant to this.
Yes, the strongest negatives for Boolean modeling is the spurious oscillations. And the hybrid model can already take care of that, so the spurious oscillations disappear.
I mean, it's interesting thinking back to the Goodwin paper that you introduced, which is actually an illustration of this, because any numerical algorithm is a discretization of the dynamical system that you're looking at. And there you see exactly the spurious oscillation just as a result of the discretization process.
Yeah, so if you see oscillations in a Boolean system, you should not necessarily believe them, yeah, that's for sure. And we don't see oscillations in our model, so
that's all right.
Yeah, I think that's a sign that we got something right. You know, that the real system is not showing oscillations.
Well, it's curious because if in the Von Dassel-Odell model, we looked at this for different reasons, and because we were interested in what happens when you move away from a purely hexagonal lattice of cells, which is in fact not what you see in epithelial sheets. They're not regular hexagonal lattices. But irrespective of that issue, one of the things that we found with the original Von Dassel-Odell model was that actually in the approach to the steady state, you see what appear to be very non-physical oscillations in some of the components.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And for that reason, we felt that the assumption that a lot of the parameter values that apparently lead to the correct steady state were perhaps not very reasonable simply because they produce this, and it seemed to be driven by these high Hill coefficients that appear.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I was curious, with your Boolean model, did you see the same phenomenon? Did you see intermediate kind of transient oscillations?
Yes.
Interrupters and
yes, and but we understand the reason for those, and that's the initial condition. Because we assume that the proteins are not there in the initial condition. So because none of the proteins are there, the transcriptional activators are not there either. And because of the severity of our assumption, all those genes that are regulated by those, they turn off and then they come back. So we do see those transients, but I think that that's really just due to the initial condition. It would not happen if we would have the proteins on in the initial condition.
And there's no persistence of those
oscillations? No persistence, and there are no limit cycles. There are some limit cycles in the asynchronous models, but they have a very small incidence.
Okay.
Yes.
Thanks.